Feeling-driven.
Willpower.
Hello and welcome to the first ever Wempower podcast. My name is Ilaria Biancacci, journalist and founder of Wempower, and I'm here today with Beatrice Savadie, human rights activist and director for Real Open Opportunities for Transformation Support.
Okay, so let me start by asking you to present a bit yourself to our readers and to Wempower Network by saying who you are and a little bit more about your story and your career and how did you arrive to create Roots.
Thank you very much, Ilaria. It's a pleasure talking to you today. My name is Beatrice Savadie. I am the founder and director of Roots, a nonprofit that's working in Zimbabwe to promote gender equality. I founded Roots in 2014 after realizing that. So I grew up in a farming and mining community called Bindura, which is about 86 kilometers from Harare, the capital city of Zimbabwe. So when I was growing up, I grew up in a poor family. I had to do gold panning for survival. At some point, I had to do street vending after school to help my parents raise some money for our upkeep. So when I was growing up, I saw my friends when we were about 14 who got married, were forced into child marriage because of the circumstances of the households that they were coming from. They were also poor. And Bindura is a rich farming and mining town, and there are a lot of resources there in terms of gold, farming land, but you find that this wealth is in the hands of the few. So they, much as the town is very much resource endowed, you find that there are a lot of poor people that live in that town. So some of my friends actually got into transactional sex. Like I'm saying that the town, there's a lot of mining that happens there. So you find that a lot of gold panners who are older men come to the this town and prey on younger girls and give them just, you know, sometimes as little as $1 for sex. So I had my friends who got into those kind of relationships, and some of them even got infected with HIV. Some of them dropped out of school when they were 14, 15. So when I was a very bright student in school, so coming from a poor household, I knew the only chance that I had at making it in life was to really become very good at school. So I then got into the junior council, then got into the junior parliament, which is sort of a replica of the senior parliament here in Zimbabwe. I was a representative of Bindura South, so the town that I'm from. So I then came to Harare as one of the junior parliament sessions for the opening. And I was surprised to see bright lights, you know, big everything coming from a small town where you think what you see is everything, like that's what's shaping your worldview. So when I came to Harare, I was like, oh, actually, there's actually a bigger life out there to aspire for, something that I could actually dream to become a part of. So it really actually inspired me to want to do more, to do well in school. So also as part of my growing up, like I said, I came from a poor background. My mom, when I started my menstruation, taught me how to use old cloth because it's the knowledge that had been passed down to her by her aunts when she was also growing up, but also she could not afford alternative like sanitary towels for me. So she initiated me to use old cloth. So after this junior parliament, I then came to Harare to study. But I was just thinking of my friends that I had left in Bindura and everything that I had, you know, grown up seeing, the injustices within the home. Sorry, so when I was in the home, we are three girls and one boy in our house, in our family. And I would see my parents treating my brother differently. They, within the home, they would give him certain, you know, privileges. They would tell him that it was okay to beat us up if, say, we're late to come home or if we've done anything wrong in their eyes or in his eyes. I would see, even with school fees, because my parents could not afford to pay all of our school fees at one go every term, they would pay for his fees first. So you'd see the boy child preference happening. Back then, I didn't have, you know, the right words for it, that it was inequality, it was, you know, boy child preference. I didn't have the right words, but something within me would tell me that, no, this is not okay. Even in the school, you would see how teachers used to treat us. They would say the girls are responsible for cleaning the classrooms, and, you know, the boys would just go and slash some grass in the playground and play football and whatnot. So it's things that I grew up seeing within my home and within the school that the schools that I went to. So when I came to do my tertiary education to Harare, I then started also facing the same issues within the college that I was attending. You'd find that we didn't have sanitary towels disposal bins within our bathrooms. So you would use a piece of, you know, whatever, cotton wool or a pad. Then you would have to carry it in your bag all the time, a used pad, because there were no disposal bins. There were erratic water supplies, but nobody was really bothered about it. And we had sort of normalized and accepted that is the norm. But it's things that I would then say, but why don't we have water? Why don't we have, you know, disposal bins? So I became part of an organization called Say What, which works with students. And that's when I would say, much as my activism and the spirit of just working towards equality started when I was younger, when I was in the junior parliament, when I started seeing injustices within the home when I was in high school, I then actively started doing it when I was in tertiary in the tertiary institution. And I started, you know, working with girls at the college that I was at to advocate for sanitary bins, to advocate for, you know, increased water supply, and started also dealing with other issues such as sexual harassment of students at the uni. So that's when I actively started doing the work. Then I then worked with other organizations, you know, that work to promote gender equality, that do gender budgeting, that do sexual and reproductive health work. But something within me wasn't fulfilled. They were good jobs and all, but I kept thinking that when I was growing up, I didn't have any role models within my community. And that's why a lot of girls felt it was okay to get married, because that's all they could see happening within their community. So I was like, okay, I want to go back to Bindura, that small town where I came from, and give back to my community and make the journey, you know, half as difficult as mine was. So I started doing that work, doing mentorship programs with girls within my town, and then got Roots formally registered in 2014. Then started to do a lot of work on gender equality, on sexual and reproductive health for adolescents. As of the work that we currently do now, we have a lot of programs that are addressing issues of gender-based violence and inequalities, and also look at issues of sexual and reproductive health for adolescents and young people, but also for women and girls. And currently, because of the lockdown and the COVID-19, it has actually exacerbated the problems that were already in existence, such as, you know, of child marriage. The work that we do, we work in farming and mining communities, which are very hard to reach areas. There are a lot of cultural practices and social norms that happen there. And there's also not a lot of access to opportunities for education for girls and for young people in general, because like for example, a high school will be 20 kilometers away from where you live and you have to walk every day. So it does not motivate young people to want to go to school. And also their parents cannot afford to send them to school. So there's because of the COVID-19, there's been an increased household poverty. We've been receiving a lot of cases where girls have been forced into child marriage. And some of the marriages are not even, if we can call them marriages at all, are not even to older men. They are, you know, love marriages amongst young people, like a 16-year-old, 17-year-old, impregnates a 13-year-old. And because of the social norms and the cultural practices already, the girls looked at us, you've defiled us if she's pregnant, and she's sent to live with that bond. So we have seen a lot of those cases. And during this lockdown also, because our hospitals and clinics were not taking any other people who don't have life-threatening cases, we had a lot of cases of young women who had, you know, limited access to contraceptives. They could not, some of the young women we met during this lockdown when we went to do mobile clinics. So we've been going to communities to provide sexual and reproductive health services. And some of the young women we met had their Depo Proveras, they had expired like 3 months back at the time that we went there because they couldn't access services. And we had a lot of cases of gender-based violence. We actually had to open an impromptu shelter to support survivors of GBV because the current organizations that were already doing the work to provide shelters for women and girls facing violence could not take in new clients. So we opened a shelter, and during the lockdown period, we managed to support about 71 people, some of them HIV positive, some of them pregnant, and some of the what we then had to do was to provide shuttle services to pick the survivors from their homes to the shelter. Because of the hard lockdown, we didn't have any public transport, you know, available for people to come and access our services. So we had to go and pick them from their homes. We also faced challenges where even when we supported the survivors to access the justice system, the police officers were saying they could not arrest the perpetrators because they couldn't take in new perpetrators because they were not prepared enough to deal with COVID. So they didn't want people coming from outside to infect. So there you would have a young woman who has been who has faced gender-based violence and is supported enough to want to seek legal recourse, but because of the ill preparedness maybe of the government, they couldn't access justice. So some of the issues that we actually then ended up getting were people defaulting from their HIV treatment because of the lockdown restrictions. And I remember we had cases of women who would be beaten up, and in that rush to just come to the shelter, they would forget to take their ARVs. So we then had to liaise with the local clinic to get them, you know, supplies for their ARVs when they come to our shelter, which is about 40 km from Harare. So there are times when we actually had to wake, you know, midnight, a survivor calls to say, okay, I've been thrown outside the house, I actually need your shelter services, and you would have to drive to go and pick them and then drive maybe about 60 km from the house to the shelter to go and give them the much needed services. So that's some of the work that we've been doing. And our work also, because of COVID, moved to, we still continued with our, we never closed our offices since the time the lockdown was introduced, but we also made sure that we would increase our virtual support for survivors of GBV, to offer psychosocial support, to offer referrals online, much as we continued with our community activities. And we also had to do advocacy work with the local authorities, because some of the issues that we saw were the increase in unpaid care work for women and girls, because the elderly could not go and access services to the at the hospitals or clinics. They were just now staying at home, and it's the young women who would be asked to take care of them. It's the women who would be asked to take care of them. Even with the water supplies, we have a lot of communities that are facing erratic water shortages. So you'd find that it's the women and girls who would go to fetch the water at the public boreholes put by the government, and there was no social distancing happening at those you know, boreholes, public boreholes. And also there's that increased fetching of water because of the increased usage in the home with the messaging around COVID-19 and washing of hands. So those are some of the issues that we're talking to the local authorities about. For example, in Bindura, when we are part of the COVID-19 response team in that province, and we had to talk to the town clerk to say, you need to increase the number of hours you are making the water supplies in the homes. And it increased from 4 hours to 7 hours. They had to buy new water pumps to increase the water supply. So that's some of the advocacy work that we've been doing during this lockdown period.
Good, that's a lot of work you guys are doing. How is Roots supported by government funding? Where do you find all the resources to keep your program going?
So during this lockdown period, we actually realized that we also had an increased burden on staff because we had to do the extra work. Like I told you, sometimes we had to drive at 12 midnight to go and pick a survivor. We had a lot of people coming to the shelter than the usual numbers that we normally have. So our funding mostly comes from development partners like UN Women and other UN agencies. With the government, we only collaborate with them as, you know, the duty bearers within our within the community that we work in. So their support is more of technical and at that collaborative level. But for financial support, it's mostly UN agencies and other development partners.
Okay. You talk about joining the Say What Association regarding the sanitary pads. I also read you put a fight with the government to reduce the tax on tampons. That's correct.
Correct. You did a lot of googling. You did a lot of googling. Yes. So in 2012, I led a campaign called the Deliver on Delayed Dignity campaign. It was a campaign to end period poverty, and most of the work that we were doing was to raise awareness around the issue because it's an issue that's is seen as a taboo and surrounded with a lot of silence. And it's such that it's not discussed even at, you know, national level. It's not seen as a priority because it's a hush-hush issue. So we did that campaign to raise awareness and to increase national dialogue around in issues of menstrual health management. And I managed to lobby the then Minister of Health, Gender Equity, who then removed the 15% tax that was being charged on sanitary towels because we were saying it was increasing the costs for the young woman. So we got that tax removed. Then we started working with the retailer so that they could actually reduce their pricing because it's still a challenge. Like I mentioned that when I was about 14, when I started my menses, my mother introduced me to using an old cloth, and now I'm 33. But this is a challenge that still women and girls that I work with within communities who are 13, 14 are still facing. So it's still a challenge that needs to be addressed. But I'm glad at that time we managed to raise, you know, national debate and dialogue around the issue and make it and break the taboo and the silence actually around periods, mm-hmm. and managed to get the government to reduce the 15% tax. The other work that we have done, our organization is a community-based organization. We work in, like I said, poorly resourced communities, farming and mining communities, but we also do work at national level, at policy level. And one of the issues that we managed to work on is on child marriage. We managed to get the government to ban child marriage in Zimbabwe as of 20 January 2016. Because our laws, the customary law was silent or still silent on the age of marriage, then the Marriage Act says a girl can consent to marriage at the age of 16. Yet our constitution says anybody who's under the age of 18 is a child. So we took the Justice Ministry and the Ministry of Human Affairs to the Constitutional Court to say we need these inconsistencies in the laws addressed because it's allowing for pedophiles to prey on younger girls. So older men would impregnate younger girls, then offer to marry them under the customary law. So to evade, to escape from, you know, saving a jail term.
What is the current situation of women rights in Zimbabwe?
Actually, we have come a long way in terms of, you know, women and girls accessing rights. In terms of laws, we have a lot of, you know, good blueprints. We have the Domestic Violence Act, we have the Public Health Act, we have all these other acts that actually, even that groundbreaking constitutional court case that we did, that are there to support women and girls' aspirations and promote gender equality. And as our government is also signatory to a lot of regional and international instruments, for example, the Maputo Plan of Action, the ISIDOR. But you find that in terms of resourcing these policies, there's still a huge gap. So you find that we have good blueprints, we have good policies, we have good laws, but in terms of implementation, it becomes very difficult. For example, during this lockdown period, when we were in hard lockdown, they had what they were calling essential services, and GBV was not part of essential services. Yet every day we were receiving calls from women and girls who were saying, "Okay, I'm in desperate need to get out of this situation." So you can see that in terms of political will, in terms of resourcing those the policies and the laws that are in existence, we still fall short in terms of making sure that women and girls empowerment is really put on the agenda. Even in terms of, if you look at our annual budgets, the national budgets, the funds that are allocated to the Ministry of Women Affairs, they are very paltry considering 52% of the population in Zimbabwe is women and girls. So you find that I think our budgets are always below 8%.
Wow.
So there isn't enough support for women and girls, even for the work that we do on child marriage. So sometimes we get grants that support second chance education, but if we don't have those grants, we go to communities and educate communities and raise awareness. And parents are like, "Oh, okay, fine, we'll stop marrying off our children." But when it comes to going back to school, the government does not have adequate support to take in those young women. So there's no life skills and livelihood support that comes in. Even with the current COVID-19 lockdown, you'd see that there were no very, meaningful social safety nets to support women and girls. I would give you, for example, we worked with sex workers during this lockdown period who had never received any form of support from the government in terms of just, food packs and whatnot so that they would stay at home. Yet they were being arrested if they were seen, doing their work to fend for their families during this lockdown period. So you find that they, like I'm saying, very good policies on paper, but which are not really supported in terms of political will, in terms of really resourcing them. Even if you look at our political participation of women in parliament, I'll give you, for example, with the quota system, we actually have lost a number of women who used to get into parliament through being elected in their constituencies. All of them have been relegated to the quota system. And with the quota system, they don't have any constituencies that they stand for. So they're just there to represent that. It's more like tokenistic, if I may say. So even in our cabinet, we don't have a lot of women in our cabinet. And if you look at countries like Rwanda and what they're doing in terms of gender equality and having more women in leadership, you see that we're still falling short in terms of even participation of women in politics. So we have made progress in terms of just advocating for laws to be there, like the Domestic Violence Act. I think it took about 10 years for that act to be in place. Right now, we're working on some of the issues like the Termination of Pregnancy Act. We've been working on this issue for the past 5 years. It hasn't been, the law has not been reviewed yet. So, we're still a long way to achieving gender equality and equity, if I may say.
Okay. I was reading on some newspaper, obviously. I don't know if this is a topic that many of our readers are aware, but Zimbabwe is going through a very complicated economical and political moments. Actually, it's been 4 years now. And I read there has been a raise of sextortion. You mentioned this before when you were talking about your village, that there were a lot of men coming and paying like $1 for girls to have sex in exchange of just a little pocket money. And actually, it had increase of, I think I saw, is a 57%, according to the Transparency International Zimbabwe. So do you do, with Roots, do you work towards also ending this sort of sextortion and sex slaveries? Do you have any programs as well related to this topic?
I think our program is basically trying to address the root causes of some of these challenges like sextortion, because we have women empowerment, economic empowerment programs that try to make sure that women and girls, you know, have some form of income and their status within the the society is improved. So our work actually works to address that, that root cause. And it actually happens even when I was in college, you would find, you know, this phenomenon called a tie for a mark, where lecturers ask, you know, female students to sleep with them for better grades. You would find, you know, girls in tertiary institutions actually doing sex work at night to fundraise for their tuition. So even in the workplace, because we still have a lot of men within our decision-making spaces, be it boards, be it just being directors of companies, even in parliament, like I was saying, you still have a lot of men in those spaces. So you find that a lot of young women fall prey, not even just young women, even older women who are married, you know, who are middle-aged, actually sometimes become victims of that sextortion, where, okay, if you sleep with me, I'll give you a job. And there's actually a term that's there for it, like carpet interview. So if you want to get the job, you have to sleep with me first. And it has not just happened in Zimbabwe. I'm sure like a year or so ago, we had cases where the UN, there were, you know, allegations of such kind of practices happening. So it happens globally, but here it then gets exacerbated because of the poverty levels. Like you mentioned, that we've been going through a period of over a decade of economic meltdown. So it's been challenging actually for women and girls to make it just based on merit.
Where do you see roots in the next 5-10 years? What are the plans for the future?
Our plans for the future, looking into, because currently we are working in about 3 provinces, so in Zimbabwe, so we expect to expand, and also expect our work to go regional, because already we have programming that's happening in Malawi and Zambia, though it's not at a bigger scale as what's happening in Zimbabwe. But that's what we envision, and to actually get more of our young women that we work with into decision-making spaces is part of the work that we've been doing to support them to get into places like the parliament, like the town councils, because the more we have people, young women representing themselves within those spaces, the more we're likely to have some of these challenges that they face addressed. So that's what we envision, to see like a better future for the young women and girls, but having more young women and girls in decision-making spaces.
That was Beatrice, Director of Roots from Zimbabwe. If you'd like to find out more about her work, visit www.rootsafrica.net. If you listen to the whole podcast, thank you so much for being here today with us. You can discover more inspiring and powerful stories at wempower.co. Buy a membership to support our journalism and follow us on social media at Wempower UK. Don't forget that together we empower women. My name is Ilaria Biancacci for Wempower Podcast. Until next time.